Blog Talk Radio.
Took me a while, but I'm finally here. So I just wanna testify, make it crystal clear. See, I've been picked out to be picked on. Talked about out my friend's mouth. I've been beat down till he turned my life around. Seems like I always fall short of being worthy. I ain't good enough, but he still loves me. I ain't no superstar, the spotlight ain't shining on me.
Welcome, and thank you for tuning in. This is a Hodge to Hodge podcast, the Messenger Edition. I am Nurse Carmen, and next we will be having a conversation with the Messenger, Ron Hodge.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you once again for tuning in to a Hodge to Hodge broadcast of the Messenger Edition. Tonight, we just want to finish up on what we started on last Thursday, Sunday night. Wow, time flies. But
yes,
we want to finish up because we were talking about the goodness of God and all that we are. And we have to come to the understanding that the things that are going on right now, they're going on because of things in which we have spoken into existence. A lot of things we don't realize we're doing it. Some we do consciously, some we do unconsciously. But I'm here to tell you that God, in a sense, does not care about these things. We place a lot of things that this is disturbing God and that is disturbing God. But, you have to understand that that is not how God truly operates. It is this dichotomy of not caring deeply about the process, but caring deeply about the results that come close to describing the dichotomy of God. Yet God, in a sense, does not even care about the outcome, not the ultimate outcome. This is because the ultimate outcome is secure. And this is the second great illusion of man, that the outcome of life is in doubt. It is this doubt about ultimate outcome that has created your greatest enemy, which is fear. For if you doubt outcome, then you must doubt Creator. You must doubt God. And if you doubt God, you must live in fear and guilt all your life. If you doubt God's intentions and God's ability to produce this ultimate result, then how can you ever relax? How can you ever truly find peace? God has full power to match intentions with results. You cannot and will not believe in this, even though you claim that God is all powerful. And so you have to create in your imagination a power equal to God, in order that you may find a way for God's will to be thwarted. And so you have created in your mythology this being you call devil. You have even imagined a God at war with this being, thinking that God solves problems the way we do. Finally, you have actually imagined that God could lose this war. All of this violates everything you say you know about God. But this doesn't matter. You live your illusions and thus feel your fear, all out of your decision to doubt God. But what if you made a new decision? What then would be the results? I tell you this, you would live as the Buddha did, as Jesus did, as did every saint you have ever idolized. Yet, with most of those saints, people would not understand you. And when you tried to explain your sense of peace, your joy in life, your inner ecstasy, they would listen to your words but not hear them. They would try to repeat your words but would add to them. They would wonder how you could have what they cannot find. And then they would grow jealous. Soon jealousy would turn to rage. And in this anger, they would try to convince you that it is you who do not understand God. And if they were unsuccessful at tearing you from your joy, they would seek to harm you. And when you told them it doesn't matter, that even death cannot interrupt your joy nor change your truth, they would surely kill you. Then, when they saw the peace with which you accepted death, they would call you saint and love you again. For it is the nature of people to love, then destroy, then love again, that which they value most. You say, but why? Why do we do that? All human actions are motivated at their deepest level by one of two emotions, fear or love. In truth, there are only two emotions, only two words in the language of the soul. These are the opposite ends of the great polarity which God created when God produced the universe and our world as we know it today. These are the two points, the Alpha and the Omega, which allows the system that we call relativity to be. Without these points, without these two ideas about things, no other idea could exist. Every human thought and every human action is based in either love or fear. There is no other human motivation, and all other ideas are but derivatives of these two. They are simply different versions, different twists on the same theme. Think on this deeply, and you will see that it's true. This is what I have called the sponsoring thought. It is either a thought of love or fear. This is the thought behind the thought behind the thought. It is the first thought. It is the prime force. It is the raw energy that drives the engine of human experience. And here is how human behavior produces repeat experience after repeat experience. It is why humans love, then destroy, then love again. Always there is the swing from one emotion to the other. Love sponsors fear, sponsors love, sponsors fear. And the reason is found in the first lie. The lie which you hold as the truth about God, that God cannot be trusted. God's love cannot be depended upon. That God's acceptance of you is conditional. That the ultimate outcome thus in doubt. For if you cannot depend on God's love to be always be there, on whose love can you depend? If God retreats and withdraws when you do not perform properly, will not mere mortal also? And so it is that in the moment you pledge your highest love, you greet your greatest fear. For the first thing you worry about after saying I love you is whether you will hear it back. And if you hear it back, then you begin immediately to worry that the love you have just found, you will lose. And so all actions become a reaction, defense against loss, even as you seek to defend yourself against the loss of God. Yet, if you knew who you are, that you are the most magnificent, the most remarkable, the most splendid being God has ever created, you would never fear. For who could reject such wondrous magnificence? Not even God could find fault in such a being. But you do not know who you are, and you think you are a great deal less. And where did you get the idea of how much less than magnificent you are? From the only people whose word you would take on everything, your mother and your father. Now, these are the people who love you the most. Why would they lie to you? Yet, have they not told you that you are too much of this and not enough of that? Have they not reminded you that you are to be seen and not heard? Have they not scolded you in some of the moments of your greatest exuberance? And did they not encourage you to set aside some of your wildest imaginings? These are the messages you receive. And though they do not meet the criteria and are thus not messages from God, they might as well have been, for they have come from the gods of your universe surely enough. It was your parents who taught you that love is conditional. You have felt their conditions many times, and that is the experience you take into your own love relationships. It is also the experience you bring to God. From this experience, you draw your conclusion about God. Within this framework, you speak your truth. God is a loving God, you say. But if you break his commandments, he will punish you with eternal banishment and everlasting damnation. For have you not experienced the banishment of your own parents? Do you not know the pain of their damnation? How then can you imagine it to be any different with God? You have forgotten what it was like to be loved without condition. You do not remember the experience of the love of God. And so you try to imagine what God's love must be like based on what you see of love in the world. You have projected the role of parent onto God and have thus come up with a God who judges and rewards or punishes based on how good he feels about what you've been up to. But this is a simplistic view of God based on your mythology. It has nothing to do with who God is. Having thus created an entire thought system about God based on human experience rather than spiritual truth, you then create an entire reality around love. It is a fear-based reality rooted in the idea of a fearful, vengeful God. Its sponsoring thoughts is wrong. But to deny that would be to disrupt your whole theology. And through the new theology, which would replace it, would truly be your salvation. You cannot accept it because the idea of a God who is not to be feared, who will not judge, and who has no cause to punish is simply too magnificent to embrace within even your grandest notion of who and what God is. This fear-based love reality dominates your experience of love. Indeed, actually creates it. For not only do you see yourself receiving love, which is conditional, you also watch yourself giving it in the same way. And even while you withhold and retreat and set your conditions, a part of you know this is not what love really is. Still, you seem powerless to change the way you dispense it. You've learned the hard way, you tell yourself, and you'll be damned if you're going to leave yourself vulnerable again. Yet, the truth is, you'll be damned if you don't. By your own mistakes, thoughts about love, do you damn yourself never to experience it purely? So to do your damn yourself never to know God as God really is, until you do. For you shall not be able to deny God forever, and the moment will come for your reconciliation. Every action taken by human beings is based in love or fear. Not simply those dealing with relationships, decisions affecting business, industries, politics, religion, the education of your young, the social agenda of the nation, the economy, goals of your society, choices involving war, peace, attack, defense, aggression, submission. To convert or give away, to save, to share, to unite or to divide. Every single choice you ever undertook arises out of one of only two possible thoughts, and they are the thought of love or the thought of fear. Fear is the energy which contracts, closes down, draws in, runs, hides, hoards, harms. Love is the energy which expands, opens up, sends out, stays, reveals, shears, heals. Fear wrapped our body in clothing. Love allows us to stand naked. Fear clings to and clutches all that we have. Love gives all that we have away. Fear holds close, love holds dear. Fear grasps, love let goes. Fear rankles, love smooths. Fear attacks, love amends. Every human thought, word, or deed is based in one emotion or the other. You have no choice about this because there is nothing else from which to choose. But you have free choice about which of these to select. Now, you have been taught to live in fear. You have been told about the survival of the fittest and the victory of the strongest and the success of the cleverest. Precisely little is said about the glory of the most loving. And so you strive to be the fittest, the strongest, the cleverest, in one way or another. And if you see yourself as something less than this in any situation, you fear loss. For you have been told that to be less is to lose. And so, of course, you choose the action fear sponsors. For that is what you have been taught. Yet I teach you this. When you choose, the action love sponsors, then will you do more than survive. Then will you do more than win. Then will you do more than succeed. Then will you be experience the full glory of who you really are and who you can be. To do this, you must turn aside the teachings of your well-meaning but misinformed worldly tutors and hear the teaching of those whose wisdom come from another source. There are many such teachers among you. As always, there has been. For God would not leave you without those who will show you, teach you, guide you, and remind you of these truths. Yet the greatest reminder is not anyone outside you, but the voice within you. This is the first tool that God uses because it is the most accessible. The voice within is the loudest voice from which God speaks because it is the closest to you. It is the voice which tells you whether everything else is true or false, right or wrong, good or bad, as you have defined it. It is the radar that sets the course, steers the ship, guides the journey, if you but let it. It is the voice which tells you right now whether the very words you are hearing are words of love or words of fear. But this measure can you determine, I'm sorry, by this measure can you determine whether they are words to heed or words to ignore. There is only one purpose for all of life, and that is for you and all that live to experience fullest glory. Everything else you say, do, or think or do is attended to that function. There is nothing else for your soul to do, and nothing else your soul wants to do. The wonder of this purpose is that it is never ending. An ending is a limitation, and God's purpose is without such a boundary. Should there come a moment in which you experience yourself in your fullest glory, you will in that instant imagine an even greater glory to fulfill. The more you are, the more you can become. And the more you can become, the more you can yet be. The deepest secret is that life is not a process of discovery, but a process of creation. You are not discovering yourself, but creating yourself anew. Seek, therefore, not to find out who you are. Seek to determine who you want to be. Well, there are those who say life is a school, that we are here to learn specific lessons, that once we graduate, we can go to a higher pursuit, no longer shackled by the body. It is another part of your mythology based on human experience. No, life is not a school. You are not here to learn a lesson. You say, okay, then why are we here? To remember and recreate who you are. I've told you over and over again, but you do not believe me. Yet, that is well as it should be. For truly, if you do not create yourself as who you are, that you cannot be. Okay, wait. Okay, so I know I've lost some people. Let's go back to the school bit. I've heard teacher after teacher tell us that life is a school. I'm frankly shocked to hear me say it. School is a place you go if there is something you do not know that you want to know. It is not a place to go if you already know a thing and simply want to experience your knowingness. Life, as you call it, is an opportunity for you to know experientially what you already know conceptually. You need learn nothing to do this. You need merely remember what you already know and act on it. Okay. You're not understanding. Okay, let's start here. The soul, your soul, knows all there is to know all the time. There's nothing hidden to it, nothing unknown. Yet knowing is not enough. The soul seeks to experience. You can know yourself to be generous, but unless you do something which displays generosity, you have nothing but a concept. You can know yourself to be kind, but unless you do someone a kindness, you have nothing but an idea about yourself. It is your soul's only desire to turn its grandest concept about itself into its greatest experience. Until concept becomes experience, all there is speculation. We all have been speculating about ourselves for a long time, longer than you and I could collectively remember, longer than the age of this universe time, the age of the universe. You see then how young is, how new is God experiencing of God's self. You lost me again. Your experience of yourself. Yes, let me explain it to you this way. In the beginning, that which is was all there was, and there was nothing else. Yet all that is could not know itself, because all that is all there was, and there was nothing else. And so all that is was not. For in the absence of something else, all that is not. That is this is the great is not to which mystics have referred from the beginning of time. The all that is knew it was all there was, but this was not enough, for it could only know its utter magnificence conceptually, not experientially. Yet the experience of itself is that for which it longed, for it wanted to know what it felt like to be so magnificent. Still, this was impossible because the very term magnificent is a relative term. All that is could not know what it felt like to be magnificent unless that which is not showed up. In the absence of that which is not, that which is not. I hope you're understanding a little better. The one thing that all that is knew is that there was nothing else. And so it could and would never know itself from a reference point outside of itself. Such a point did not exist. Only one reference point existed, and that was the single place within, the is not is, the am not am. Still, all of everything chose to know itself experientially. This energy, this pure, unseen, unheard, unobserved, and therefore unknowing by anyone else, energy chose to experience itself as the utter magnificence it was. In order to do this, it realized it would have to use a reference point within. It reasoned quite correctly that any portion of itself would necessarily have to be less than the whole, and that if it thus simply divided itself into portions, each portion being less than the whole, could look back on the rest of itself and see magnificence. And so all that is divided itself, becoming in one glorious moment that which is this, and that which is that. For the first time, this and that existed, quite apart from each other, and still both existed simultaneously, as did all that was neither. Thus, three elements suddenly existed, that which is here, that which is there, and that which is neither here nor there, but which must exist for here and there to exist. It is the nothing which holds the non-space which holds the space. It is the all which holds the parts. Now, I know I've said a lot. I hope you can understand what it is that I'm trying to get you to understand a little bit more in a different perspective about this God that we are serving, and we don't know who it is that we're really serving. Now, I'm going to go further. Now, this nothing which holds the everything is what some people call God. Yet, that is not accurate either, for it suggests that there is something God is not, namely, everything that is not nothing. But God is all things, seen and unseen. So this description of God as the great unseen, the no thing, or the space between, an essential Eastern mystical definition of God, is no more accurate than the essential Western practice description of God as all that is seen. Those who believe that God is all that is and all that is not are those whose understanding is correct. Now, in creating that which is here and that which is there, God made it possible for God to know itself. In the moment of this great explosion from within, God created relativity, the greatest gift God ever gave to itself. Thus, relationship is the greatest gift God ever gave to you, a point to be discussed later. From the no thing thus sprang the everything. A spiritual event entirely consists, incidentally, with that you scientists call the Big Bang Theory. As the elements of all race forth, time was created. For a thing was first here, and then it was there. And the period it took to get from here to there was measurable. Just as the parts of itself which were seen began to define themselves relative to each other, So too did the parts which were unseen. God knew that for love to exist and to know itself as pure love, exact opposite had to exist as well. So God voluntarily created the great polarity, the absolute opposite of love. Everything that love is not, what is now called fear. In the moment fear existed, love could exist as a thing that could be experienced. It is this creation of duality between love and its opposites, which humans refer to in their various mythologies as the birth of evil, the fall of Adam, the rebellion of Satan, and so forth. Just as you have chosen to personify pure love as the character you call God, so have you chosen to personify abject fear as the character you call the devil. Now, I'm going to stop now because I want to give you a little time. If someone wants to say something or ask a question or anything, but it's important for us to understand what was just said because it's defining for you. It's allowing you to see God in a different way. What I've just explained to you should help you better understand how you are connected. You are part of the body of God. So it is important for you to go within. Have that talk with God. But stop looking to the hills and stop looking to the east and to the west and look within. I'm going to ask one more time if anyone has anything that they'd like to say. If they do, now would be the time. Well, I'm going to just add just a little bit to it before we close out the show. God's divine purpose in dividing God was to create significant parts of God so that God could know itself experientially. There is only one way for the Creator to know itself experientially as a Creator, and that is to create. And so God gave to each of the countless parts of him, which is all of us, his spiritual children, the same power to create which God has as the whole. This is what your religion means when it says that you are created in the image and likeness of God. This doesn't mean, as some have suggested, that our physical bodies look alike. Although God can adopt whatever physical form God chooses for a particular purpose, It does mean essence is the same. We are composed of the same stuff. We are the same stuff with all the same properties and abilities, including the ability to create physical reality out of thin air. Now, I know that might sound kind of funny to some people. Create physical reality out of thin air. But if every one of us that are listening to my voice right now would stop for a moment, and you can remember times that you've created stuff out of thin air. And a lot of things, the first thing out of your mouth is, look at God. And that is correct, look at God, but it's the God in you. And
right.
That's what you have to understand. It's the God in you. You did that. It's not sacrilegious or blasphemy to say that you did it, because you are part of the body of God. God's purpose in creating you, his spiritual offspring, was for God to know God's self as God. God had no way to do that except through you. Thus it can be said, and has been many times, that God's purpose for you is that you should know yourself as God. This seems so amazingly simple, yet it becomes very complex, because there is only one way for you to know yourself as God, and that is for you to know yourself as not God. Now try to follow this, because this gets very subtle here. Remember, now I'm going to keep this thing simple. I'm going to use the Children of God mythology model as a basis for discussion, because it is a model with which you're familiar with, and in many ways, it is not that far off. So let's get back to how this process of self-knowing. There is one way God can cause all of his spiritual children to know themselves as a part of God, and that was simply to tell them. And God did. But you see, it was not enough for spirit to simply know itself as God, or part of God, or children of God, or inheritors of the kingdom, or whatever mythology you want to use. As I've already explained, knowing something and experiencing it are two different things. Spirit longed to know itself experientially, just as God did. Conceptual awareness was not enough. So God devised a plan. It is the most extraordinary idea in all the universe and the most spectacular collaboration. And I say corroboration because all of us are in it with God. We all got together and came up with this plan. Under the plan, you are pure spirit. You as pure spirit would enter the physical universe just created. This is because physicality is the only way to know experientially what you know conceptually. It is, in fact, the reason God created the physical cosmos to begin with, and the system of relativity which governs it, and all creation. Once in the physical universe, God's spirit children could experience what you know of yourself, but first you had to come to know the opposite. To explain this simplistically, you cannot know yourself as tall until you become aware of short. You cannot experience the part of yourself that you call fat unless you also come to know thin. Taken to ultimate logic, you cannot experience yourself as what you are until you've encountered what you are not. This is the purpose of the theory of relativity and all physical life. It is by that which you are not that you define yourself. Now, in the case of the ultimate knowing, in the case of knowing yourself as the creator, you cannot experience yourself as creator unless and until you create. And you cannot create yourself until you uncreate yourself, in a sense. You have to first not be in order to be. Now, I'm going to stop right there. I hope you was able to get that. You have to first not be in order to be. In order for you to know the good, what we call good, you've got to know what we call bad.
Right. Amen.
Okay? And because we have to know this, and this is why, you know, I'm always saying all things are working together for the good. Mm-hmm. Because what we're looking at as good, God isn't looking at it as good. And what we're looking at as bad, God isn't looking at it as bad. It's all of it is the same. It's all good. It's all working together for what we call the good. We just have to see that and know that and believe that. Then a lot of the things that just bum us out and have us just so worried about everything, it won't have as much authority over us. We won't be as concerned about certain things. Why? Because we truly know who we are and we know what the outcome is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could take whatever religion you want, and once again, I'm not here to down religion. I'm just here to let you know that there is another way. Because you have to understand, when I say there is another way, I say it because no matter what religion tells you, no matter what, there is only one place. When this body is no more good, when we've done everything we can to kill this body off, you do not die. And you have to understand this. And I use a simple analogy for people to understand, and they don't seem to get it, but if people die, how can we have these dreams? How can we have these premonitions of them still being here? And when we have them, it's so lifelike. It's lifelike because it is what it is. And we need to give it that. And when that happens, that should be something that is encouraging to our spirit to let us know. Think about all the people that have passed on and have come back to you. Nobody's ever came back to you and told you, oh, I messed up and this place is just too much. And according to us, we know a lot of people that shouldn't be where they are. We think they should be, quote unquote, in some fiery pit. But when that person has come back to you, he didn't come back thinking of talking about no fiery pit. So I hope something was said tonight that would stir up the gift in you, that you might have that talk with God, that you might come to better understand just who you are and who you're trying to be. I love you all very much. I thank you for tuning in, and I pray that you'll show favor to show up again on Thursday at 8 o'clock. We're here. I love you all. Good night, and have a great week.
Love you. Good night. Thank you.
Stay warm. Good night, everyone.
Good night.